From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Why colleges and universities are worried today and what their classrooms might look like 10 years from now.
Later, poet Jamie Hill says even when there's a product, the process never really ends.
For me, the poem's not done until it's published, and then even then it might, you know, it might still be something I want to look at and work on. This is my first book, so having everything in a book and being finished is a little strange.
And a world premiere show at the Milwaukee Rep is about the late John Denver, but also much more.
It's couched in me being on the road with John Denver and my relationship with this other human being, but it's also about the struggles of keeping a relationship alive, the struggles of being in your job and making that job real every time you do it.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news.
This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The White House issued its first college scorecard this week. It's a website designed to help people compare costs and offerings across all the public and private colleges and universities in the country. It's a tool that its designers hope will be useful in connecting schools with their future students.
But for as competitive as college admissions can be today, Brian Alexander believes the schools will be increasingly hard-pressed to fill their classrooms a few years down the road. But he says for the students who are in college, technology will be playing an even bigger role in their education. Alexander is a researcher in the future of technology and higher education and was in Milwaukee this week to talk about both with faculty at Marquette University. Brian Alexander, welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's good to be back in Milwaukee.
Well, you've been in Milwaukee to talk with faculty at Marquette University about the classroom of the future. And so let me ask you this. Why is the issue of the future such a thorny one to take on a college campus?
It is. And in fact, when I speak about technology, I often speak about that second. First, I speak about the future of education because technology itself is often scary or distanced from many faculty and a great deal of academic staff, in fact, a great deal of people. But the future of education is something that everybody is keenly interested in now, which is a change from where it was, I think, 10 years ago.
Well, and I would imagine that depending on the discipline and the specialty that the faculty has, mm-hmm. that probably has a significant influence on how willing they are to embrace change.
It does. Generally speaking, the sciences tend to use technology more than any other field, followed by the social sciences, especially the quantitatively intensive ones like economics, followed then by the humanities and the fine arts. But I think in general, most faculty are very nervous about change. Academia has often promised a kind of stability that we no longer seem to guarantee. And that, I think, threatens everybody. And then different disciplines approach this with different ways. Some of them shaped by the content of the discipline. I mean, economics professors tend to view this through an economic lens, humanists through textual, historical, and so on. But we also see this politically and through our life experience. So it's a pretty complex situation.
And is your job to set their mind at ease or is it to challenge them and cause them to run screaming from the room?
More the latter, I'm afraid. that's because I'm a realist. I have the luxury of being a full-time researcher, so I spend all year researching what's happening with higher education. And then I also work through social media, so I have a virtual army of hundreds of people who work with me, who throw stories my way, who correct me, push back, have a conversation to help sharpen what I research. And in general, the mood in higher education across the United States is one of nervousness. Many people are very frightened about where education is going. They don't see many bright paths forward. They don't have confidence in politics. And they tend to also be worried for their own institution's fate. And I find this to be independent of an institution's financial health or their geographical location. I've heard from very, very well-endowed schools that they are very nervous about the future, for example.
Why are they worried about it if it's independent of the school's financial condition?
One reason is because of demographics. The United States population of people aged 1 to 18 has been going down. And thanks to the recession, it looks like people in their 20s are less likely to have children or to have them later. So we're going to be dealing with this problem for quite some time. And meanwhile, of course, the flip side is our population over 60 continues to grow, both in absolute numbers and proportionally. So one problem is we have fewer traditional age undergraduates going into higher education. The adult education market seems saturated, So it looks like colleges and universities may be in a tight competition for a shrinking pool of students. And one way to respond is by recruiting aggressively internationally. But within the United States, this is a very large challenge. Second problem is that most Americans are horrified at what they see as the combination of high prices that colleges charge as well as the specter of student debt. I mean, student debt is roughly $1.3 trillion in the United States. It's an extraordinary number, higher than any debt short of mortgages. And this terrifies parents, and I think higher education professionals realize this and are worried about what it means.
Well, and I think I was reading actually something that you wrote about the state of things in Japan right now, where no less a person than the prime minister has been directing universities to cut their social science and humanities programs, in part because classrooms in colleges and universities are half empty.
Exactly. That was the Minister of Education. I think the full title is Education, Sports, Culture, and Health. But the minister said we need to close and reboot all the social science and humanities. Some universities, including the flagship University of Tokyo, said no, this is crazy. About 29 said okay, and we're on it. In the United States, we've seen smaller examples of this. I call this the queen sacrifice. You know, in chess. A player can sacrifice their queens, a desperate move to try and win. And I've been finding dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of colleges and universities that are closing entire programs, firing tenured faculty as well as untenured faculty in order to respond to demographic and economic challenges. It's the, you know, it's the bread and butter. You know, it's the queen of a campus. And we're at the stage where even though we technically have a financial recovery as a nation, we're still at the stage of cutting education.
Well, and so what are the ramifications for this? Not in Japan necessarily, but in the United States where, you know, these colleges and universities kind of became what they are for having this sort of robust offering.
Well, about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, we reached a peak of total undergraduate enrollment in the United States. And that number has gone down every year since. Now, it's possible this is a blip and we'll start going back up again, but the demographics are against it. So it's possible that in the near or medium-term future, we will simply have fewer colleges and universities. We'll have some that just close or go out of business. Sweetbriar, for example, had a near-death experience. I love the college. I love the people there, but I'm worried about their sustainability. And there are many, many private and public universities and colleges that are facing this. It's also possible that we will simply have smaller student bodies on campuses, in which case we will probably have fewer tenured faculty and more part-time, that is adjunct faculty, in order to be able to sustain it. That's, you know, we may be heading to the 50% slack capacity that Japan is now showing us in the present.
Are students coming out of K-12 education and getting to college campuses with a different understanding for or expectation from technology than they're getting?
Well, generally speaking, if we're talking about traditional age undergraduates, you know, people aged 18 to 22, they tend to have more experience in the digital world on their own than anywhere else. In the second place, they tend to have more experience in the digital world in K through 12 than they will in higher education. And that's in part – that's for various reasons. But many states and the K through 12 professions have really pushed hard to include technology in the classroom, especially early levels, you know, the primary level. Higher education is a little different. We've often resisted that, and in part because our faculty, the ones that are tenure track, have such a tradition of autonomy. That isn't really quite the case in K-12 teachers. But we also have distance learning, which is branching out, and many, many institutions are getting into distance learning. In part, they think it will save money. It usually doesn't, but it's a way to grow their student body, partly competing with adults or competing for adults, but also trying to get more international students. I mean, that's where MOOCs came from. MOOCs have always had the greatest number of students outside of the U.S. I mean, in many ways, MOOCs are kind of the most representative online learning platform there are. They haven't destroyed higher education. In fact, in many ways, they act kind of like, you know, digital textbooks on steroids. But I think the K-12 experience is very, very important. I think a lot of students are accustomed to a certain level of digital fluency that they don't experience when they're in higher education.
What about the emphasis on the STEM fields in both K-12 and on into higher education? Because obviously places where they're cutting humanities programs, that comes at the same time where they're boosting programs like education and math and other technological fields.
Well, absolutely. I would set education aside from that for the moment, Mitch. This is a terrific question. There's a general sense that we need more students doing more STEM work, and we need that from first grade through graduate school. It's not clear that's actually needed, though, because we don't have a labor problem with people not getting enough jobs. In fact, in many ways, it looks like the businesses are trying not to get more workers but cheaper workers. Most notoriously, Disney a couple of months ago did a spectacular thing where they laid off a swath of technicians, ordered them to train the replacements who were entirely from East Asia. It was a very bitter moment, and there was no need for it except saving a little bit of money, which Disney wasn't really in need of. In general, it seems that the technology companies simply want to keep labor costs down, and that's part of the demand. But there's another reason, which is the sense of the 21st century is one that is really STEM-driven. I mean, we're seeing enormous developments in biological science and, of course, in computing, not to mention in robotics. And we have a sense that we need to prepare a population who can first work in that professionally, but also in general to have students that are proficient with this. I mean, the National Science Foundation has been celebrating what it calls computational thinking and asks that every graduate of a class be able to think, what does a computer add? How does a computer approach a problem so that we can better think about data and modeling and so on? I think the pressure for STEM nevertheless is very, very high. Especially the United States has a lamentable problem where, unlike most of the developed world, we have this strange gender skew where many STEM fields are massively dominated by men. And this has happened since the 1980s. We have a lot of programs for solving it, and we're not solving it. So one part of the emphasis you described is to try to fix up the gender balance and get more women and girls involved. Education is a trickier one, though. Some schools, some areas have actually been cutting education programs, especially in areas demographically like the upper Midwest and like the Northeast, where we are seeing fewer and fewer K through 12 kids. So there's probably less of a need for teachers. That said, there are quite a few cities where we're experiencing teacher shortfalls. We're seeing this in the South and the West. I think in part that's because the field of education is so conflicted right now at the K through 12 level. But we do see people pushing in some areas for more educators.
Well, so help us look into the future. Let's take an example. We'll take, say, my son or anyone else born in 2008 in second grade now. What's a college classroom going to look like in 10 or 11 years when he gets there?
Just a decade, Mitch, you're going to be looking at this. Just as a note to help us think about this problem, the White House used an interesting phrase to describe your son's generation. We have Generation X, which is probably you, right?
That would be me, yes.
Yeah, and myself. We have boomers and so on, millennials. But they use the term the homeland generation. And when I first saw this, I recoiled. I thought it was a strange term. But the idea was that describes a population that has no memory of the world before September 11th, 2001. Either they were born after it, like your son, or they were just too young to recall that. And that, I think, is a useful term to make us think about the huge, huge break. I think you'll see a lot of things in the classroom, assuming that your son does go to a university classroom, which he might not. It's quite possible that he'll take classes from home. This is what a lot of families do in Europe and in Asia, where the students still live at home and they take classes nearby when they commute. Or it's possible that your son will live on his own in an apartment, which I know is a terrifying prospect in some ways and a utopian prospect in others, but may live in an apartment with other students. I'm waiting to see communities or at least apartment buildings formed just for this purpose to support 18-year-olds when they get to work online. But if he goes to a classroom physically, you can expect a few different things. I mean, assume the classroom is saturated with electromagnetism. Assume that the student will have access to all kinds of internet technologies. Now, the teacher may or may not use all of them, but let's presume that the students will be able to research online. So if the teacher is giving a lecture about the French Revolution and mentions a person that your son doesn't recall, he can quickly Google the name, assuming Google still exists. And I hope it does. If it doesn't exist in 10 years, we have other problems to worry about. presumably the classroom will have a multimedia experience, that there may be something like a very, very large interactive screen and or whiteboard. Possibly in 10 years that the teacher will be communicating with the technology entirely by voice and or gesture rather than by typing in a keyboard. It's possible the students will have access to computational devices that are largely invisible, that either they are earbuds or perhaps rings or something just enclosed in their pockets, and they may communicate with them either by voice or by gesture. And then the classroom experience will be a kind of three-way dialogue between the instructor, the students, and the entire planet. It's possible that we will continue to have problems of attention, which is, of course, a pre-digital problem of getting students to pay attention, or put another way, of getting faculty to teach in a lively enough way to compel students' attention. It's possible that we may have solved that problem. I suspect not. I suspect we'll continue dealing with it. And your son will be manipulating different technologies as he works through these different classes. I was speaking of a humanities class that isn't necessarily about technology. It's likely that your son will probably take a class that is to some extent grounded in technology. He may take a class in computer game design or in animation. Any of the sciences or social sciences that he takes will probably have some healthy amount of either technological instrumentation, think of astronomy, but also manipulating a lot of data. And it's possible that increasingly, if he takes a humanities class, that the humanities classes will have a lot of data. Your son, the student, takes a class in the American Civil War and is able to process huge numbers of data concerning Union victories or concerning when slaves were freed and became independent human beings. So he may really be existing in a digital world in ways that we can glimpse now, but will simply become normative then and perhaps old-fashioned at that point.
The real question is, when he's living in that apartment, will he pick up his socks?
That is an ancient, ancient problem. And in 10 years, one has to wonder just how far robotics will have come, where he can have his Roomba version 12.0 simply do that for him. I suspect that Roomba 12.0 will still terrify the cats, or at least intrigue them. The robotics angle is one that we really are starting to rethink now. It's an old dream. It goes back to the Jetsons. It goes back before that. I mean, the term robot itself comes from a wonderful Czech play called Rossum's Universal Robots. And we are now seeing the point where robotics and artificial intelligence have advanced to a degree that they are really beginning to change the way we live. You guys in Milwaukee, you must have automated checkout.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And does your library have a self-checkout?
It does indeed.
Which is, you know, in many ways the ultimate shy person's venue. But we're seeing this begin to take off in quite a few places. And we're seeing that robotics have begun to displace labor and change the way we think and work. And in 10 years, this is going to be a subject that we will be dealing with. In fact, in curriculum of K-12 as well as higher education, we now have to think not just are we preparing students to build robots, but we have to think, are we training students for jobs that may not exist 10 years from now? In which case, do we have to prospectively think, should we redesign a curriculum so that we emphasize what humans do better than robots? And can we actually do that? Are we good enough at that?
Well, it is a lot to think about. And Brian Alexander, thank you so much for getting us started.
Oh, my pleasure, Mitch. It's great talking with you.
Brian Alexander is a researcher and futurist in the field of higher education and technology. He was the keynote speaker yesterday at Marquette University's first Faculty Technology Day. You'll find a link to more about him from WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now, and then Milwaukee poet Jamie Hills wins an award for her first published collection. We'll speak with her when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. One published collection into her career, Milwaukee poet Jamie Hills is an award winner.
Hills' new book is called How to Avoid Speaking, and it's the recipient of the 10th Anthony Hecht Poetry Prize. The poems have a little something for everyone in terms of style, tone, form, and subject matter. And if you're looking for poems that feature Brad Pitt, well, you're in luck. More about that in just a few minutes.
Jamie Hills joins us in the studio now to talk a bit about her work, and we'll hear some of it as well. Very nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Talk about the process of writing poetry for you. Where does it start? Is everything fair game, if you will?
Pretty much. Usually it's a phrase that sort of intrigues me. So one example, when I had my first daughter, we had some complications during pregnancy, and the thing that was it turned out to be was called a true knot. So I was like, oh, this phrase is really non-medical for like a weird medical thing. So I wrote a poem called True Knot, and it kind of explores the word but plus the experience. So it's not just about the words but tying them into what's happening and where they are and situated.
Is there always a notebook with you? Do you, I mean, do you rely on remembering those quirky words or phrases, or are there always poems in progress?
There's always poems in progress. If I really need a phrase, I'll write it on my phone or something. But it's usually happening in my head, and then when I have time, I'll write it down later.
The new collection features poems about everything from Hemingway to Q-tips to synesthesia to Rasussa Annie. And in many different forms, how do you go from having this idea to deciding what the poem's going to look like and feel like?
Sometimes there's a line that has to be a certain way. Sometimes, you know, the theme will fit in with the way a form, a traditional verse form works. So synesthesia, I kind of, you know, there's the sonnet that has the argument, and then you kind of argue with yourself. So that worked for that kind of thing because you set up what synesthesia is and then how maybe it breaks down a little. And usually it's kind of like I do write in traditional forms, but then I'll modify it the way from when I like a phrase a certain way. So then I'll try to pair, copy that in the next stanza so it comes in, becomes a nonce form. That's my favorite kind.
Do you do a lot of rewriting?
Oh, yeah. For me, it's the poem's not done until it's published, and then even then it might, you know, it might still be something I want to look at and work on. So having – this is my first book, so having everything in a book and being finished is a little strange. I still – you know, I guess they're done.
But you reserve the right to make them not be done.
I think I have enough to other things to work on, so I'll decide this is done. Definitely.
Well, what attracted you to poetry in the first place versus any other writing form?
I think it's the wordplay mostly that I really like and enjoy, and that there's, you know, you develop a pattern in language with a poem that you wouldn't necessarily improvise. So I really like that aspect, and I like the shortness of it. It's just kind of you can see everything on one page and you know, modify it. It's more similar to a painting, I guess. So you have like a visual component to it.
How old were you when you started writing?
In high school, I took a creative writing class and I really enjoyed that. And then in college, I was going to be a pre-med student, and I was for several years. But my major was always writing because I really enjoyed my writing classes. And poetry was what I just gravitated to, I think, because that was where my talent lie.
Well, and so this collection represents how many years of writing for you?
It's probably – the oldest one is probably 10 years old. So it's not like I've been working on the book for 10 years, but it's it's the best things that I've written over the past 10 years, I think, that kind of have a theme that go together.
Well, and when you look back at the poet you were 10 years ago – and you look at the stuff that you're writing today, how do you think you have most significantly evolved as a poet?
I think it's because this is the book won a formalist contest, so it's a lot of poems are in form, and I think the earlier ones are kind of more strictly adherent to a form or what might have been an assignment at the time in college. But I'm much more interested in playing around with form and innovating in form. So another poem that would be an example would be –
And maybe you want to read one for us.
Oh, sure. There's a whole section that looks at different letters of the alphabet. And I haven't finished the alphabet. That was my regret for the book that I didn't finish the alphabet. But so I'll just read on S, which plays around with when you remove S from a word and how it becomes a new word. So it's kind of like a rhyme but a little bit different. And this poem is in the voice of Eve. On S. S is for sin. I knew what we were in for. How could we exist without an exit? He called me his apostrophe, a she, his little rib. What soul, what self? I wanted to be singular. In the beginning, there was light, but it was slight. a soft wan-colored swan, a shallow lake to slake our thirsty throats, an often hollow place with susurrating psalms in the palm fronds. But a slow hiss announced itself. The windswept willows wept. At 30, my possessive ex and I were fruitful, peeking naked, multiplied our sex. But soon his low snaked tongue in speaking forked our sour sons, our daughter, and myself with words of swords, and I returned both cursed and cured, ears seared with newfound knowledge, turned our laughter into slaughter.
That's Jamie Hill's reading On S from her new collection, How to Avoid Speaking. First of all, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And secondly, it's interesting to consider that poem because in listening to it, the significance of those S's doesn't necessarily jump out at you the way you see them when you look down at the printed page.
Right.
Which I think gets to what you were saying about the visual component of a poem versus just the versus the sound.
Yeah. And so for these poems, I guess it was – I had a collection of – it's kind of like writing a poem backwards because I had the collection of word pairs, so sin and in and laughter and slaughter. So I wouldn't recommend anyone writing a poem this way. That's why I wasn't able to do all the whole alphabet. But so it just is – I had the words and then you kind of they're in persona personas so that I could figure out who was saying these words and how it worked. And so on S kind of – you know, the S sort of curves like a snake, so it's seemed obvious. And snaked and naked brought me to Eve in the Garden of Eden.
There is a series of poems that makes up the title poem, or maybe it's a multi-part poem. What inspired How to Avoid Speaking as a concept?
Well, it's basically about my speaking anxiety, and just going over it in different life stages. If this were a how-to advice book, the first piece of advice would be don't write a book because then you'll have to speak about it.
Well, and kudos to you for coming on this show.
Oh, thank you. Talking to one person face-to-face is a little bit different than, you know, in front of a crowd. Or that's where my speaking anxiety would result, maybe in a big party or something like that.
Are you not one that likes to get up and at a poetry slam, for example?
Oh, no. I would die of embarrassment.
Brad Pitt makes at least a couple of appearances in this collection, which might have struck me as unlikely until I started reading it. There is a certain attraction you have to pop culture.
I thought you were going to ask me an attraction to Brad Pitt.
Well, I could ask you that too.
I like the mixture of pop culture and maybe more traditional things. But there's two Brad Pitt poems. So
I feel like we ought to hear one of them. Okay. Perhaps, up to you.
Okay, well, I'll read The Poet is Anti-Capitalist.
Okay.
And Denise Duhamel has a poem in a similar form which uses Sean Penn's name. So all the words that end the lines have a pen in the word. So I did something very similar and just used Pitt. So here it is. Poet is Anti-Capitalist. You're no hillbilly Jed Clampett, dear Brad Pitt. He discovered a crude, bubbling serendipity, shooting rabbits out back as the ground spit gold. But you know about coincidence. The pitfalls of dating two celebrities at once. The pitchfork crowd from that time you were a vampire, both decrepit and pretty. Can you tell me why then, Brad Pitt, in Fight Club, slippery as an avocado pit, they showed a theater in the background, and pitted against the sky was a poster of a film starring Brad Pitt. Why then did your cocky, fist-fighting, anti-capitalist character sip beer then tell Edward Norton, low-pitched, what are we then? We're consumers. The recapitulation of a statement you made while in a mental hospital in 12 Monkeys, ranting from your crazy pulpit. Brad, can I call you Brad? I work for a pittance. You're filthy rich. If oil is capitalism, poetry is water. They don't quite mix. The pitter-patter of rain is free. A running tap marks H and C spits the life-sustaining source and can fill a pitcher, a tub, two-thirds a body, a poem. But capitalism rains the water on the island of Fiji and muddies my pithy metaphor for poetry a bit. Precipitation there is still puddle wonderful, despite the fact that Fiji's local tap water is a cesspit, and that the Fiji company's grip on the epitome of bottled chic creates a bottomless pit of plastic. Living in Fiji must be the pits. But you can see how oil is worse. The turpitude of war, the Gulf spill. Where shall we dig next? Jupiter? I know what you're thinking. Doesn't this Brad Pitt poem addressed to me, the illustrious Brad Pitt, veer away from its subject? I could launch a spitball at you, Brad. I know you've drunk in Fiji water, a pity, and every BP station shares your monogram, Pitt. I'm not in love with you, Brad, you astralopithecine.
And so the challenge you laid out to yourself is finding as many words with P-I-T or P-I-T-T in them. And it's really impressive to know that that australopithecine and recapitulation and hospital and pittance all had something in common.
Yeah.
Some of these poems are really laugh-out-loud funny in places. And now I know you're teaching more general writing kinds of subjects in this semester at Marquette, but I wonder, as you've been involved working with undergraduates, whether you encounter typical misconceptions about poetry as a form when you work with them?
Oh, definitely. I remember the first time I taught and I brought out some poems. It was just for a composition course, and I saw one student just immediately put her head down and like she was not going to be able to deal with this. And I think poetry is, you know, the assumption is that it's erudite and it's difficult. And it really doesn't have to be. There's all different types of poetry, just the way there's all different types of novels. So I think that's also why I'm drawn to, you know, the funny or pop culture, just because it doesn't have to just be about the big, you know, about death or something like that.
Well, right. I wonder if there are college students out there, and I will admit to maybe having been one of them myself a long time ago, who look at poetry and think that they need a decoder ring to get it.
Right. Yeah. I think that's how it probably operates in high school. Like, people are told that, you know, a rose means love, or a horse is, like, you know, the poem itself. Different symbols do exist, and I think it just sort of kind of makes it a little daunting to read. You know, there's different layers that, you know, you can read a poem about a rose and just enjoy it for its description. I actually have another poem I like to read that
absolutely
kind of deals with this subject, Birds, which is just a list of birds. There is no deeper meaning. So I'll go ahead and read it. Birds. Diamond dove, mast fin foot, tundra swan, wandering tattler, splendid fairy wren, chestnut-backed jewel babbler, nightingale, snail kite, rufous-headed pygmy tyrant, yellow-bellied sapsucker, spike-heeled lark, horned screamer, greater necklace laughing thrush, squirrel cuckoo, harlequin duck, anhinga, sun grebe, cinnamon tanager, noisy friar bird, black-fronted nun bird, speckled chakalaka, painted bunting, little spotted kiwi, lizard buzzard, long-wattled umbrella bird, yellow-faced honey-eater, oven bird, star-throated ant wren, topaz-frilled coquette, Dead Sea sparrow, sooty albatross, sociable weaver, firewood gatherer, rusty-cheeked scimitar babbler, zebra finch, helmeted mannequin, apostle bird, spectacled monarch, emerald toucanet, violet saberwing, pied butcher bird, dark chanting goshawk, red-necked avocet, tawny frogmouth, secretary bird, northern flicker, fan-tailed berry picker, emperor penguin, sapphire-rumped parrotlet, boat-billed heron, hermit hummingbird, chimney swift, antenna satin bird, harpy eagle, golden whistler, brambling, violet-fronted brilliant, purple swamp hen, silver eye, pink pigeon, rosy-faced lovebird.
Jamie Hill's reading Birds. Do you are you entertained by the notion that someone who knows nothing of your work might pick up this collection and try to come up with a meaning from that poem?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting, there's all this description and metaphor even in the just actual names of birds. So I think, yeah, someone can try and read the deeper inner psyche that brought me to read this, brought me to write this birds poem, or what trauma created that birds poem.
Well, fortunately, it is not a trauma to read your work. Let me just say, Jamie Hills, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
J.
Jamie Hill's new collection of poems is called How to Avoid Speaking. It's published by the Waywiser Press. Hills is also a lecturer in the English department at Marquette University.
One more break, and then we'll meet the man behind the story of Back Home Again, On the Road with John Denver. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Excellent words. I can hear them now. This is the picture.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
All my bags are packed. I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye.
If you were around in the 1970s, the music of John Denver was all around you.
Even though John Denver died almost 20 years ago, his songs remain iconic, from Leaving on a Jet Plane to Thank God I'm a Country Boy to Rocky Mountain High and many more. To many, Denver still epitomizes a distinctly American singer-songwriter style, transcending folk, pop, and country to sell millions and millions of records and win many awards.
Singer-songwriter and Broadway composer Dan Wheatman spent 8 years in John Denver's band, and he was good friends with the singer. Back Home Again, On the Road with John Denver, which just opened at the Milwaukee Rep's Stackner Cabaret, showcases the music of Denver through the experiences that Wheatman had touring with him. Wheatman, who co-wrote the production with Randall Myler, was in town last week, and he explained how and why the show came together.
It's something that Randy has talked about for a long time. He's always wanted to do this. And I was very reluctant to do a show about me. It just seems I'm not very ego-driven in the world, and to do a show about me seemed, I don't know. Anyway, he came up and he pitched it here, and they took it. So then I had to write it.
So how did you approach it, since you were reluctant initially to do so?
Well, Randy and I have a great writing partnership. We are very good with each other and in suggestions and moving things around. So when this came up, I just sat down and wrote the whole story, unedited. All the little details through, you know, where I was living and who I was playing with and da-da-da-da-da-da, and on and on and on. And then brought it here, and we started working on it and going, well, this isn't moving the plot forward, and this is information we don't need, and then suggesting things, and the two of us hammered it out. And with the help of the cast, too, because that's the way we work. We're very inclusive in our process, and we try to work with really good people all the time. David Lutkin, who is playing me in the show, you know, he's been on Broadway and Will Rogers, and he was in the original Civil War, and is I knew him. I met him in Aspen in the 80s. We were splitting nights at a club in Aspen. So I've known David for a long time, and he's very smart and had suggestions about things that would make him more comfortable. And that's how we worked. That's how we put it together.
The show is billed about being about John Denver, but it is really about you and your relationship with him and what it was like being on tour.
And not only that, but John's life and my life are very parallel. We came to Aspen about the same time. We got divorced around the same time. I mean, there are a lot of things that locked up. And there's that kind of reflection of our lives throughout the whole play.
How did you and John meet initially? Was it a gig thing? Or?
I was living in Aspen. I was playing as a solo artist, and there was a band, Liberty, that I was dear friends with. And they were playing at a place called the Red Onion. It was a great nightclub in town, and John was a friend of theirs. And I was standing out in front of the club one night, and John walked up, and they introduced me, and we went inside. And this story will lead right into the song. So we walked inside the club, and they asked John to come up and sit in with them. And
what year was this?
This was 76.
Okay, so he already had quite some fame and fortune at this point.
Oh, yeah, he was John Denver at this point. So he got up on stage, and he had recorded a song by one of the guys in Liberty, and they did that. And then he called the band around him, and he got in a huddle, and he turned around. He was really excited. He said, I just wrote a brand new song. And it was the first time he played this for anyone. And it's my favorite John Denver song. I just happened to be in the audience the night he did it. So he wrote this for his Uncle Dean. Had an uncle named Matthew, was his father's only boy. Born just south of Colby, Kansas, was his mother's pride and joy. Yes, and joy was just the thing that he was raised on. Love was just a way to live and die. Gold was just a windy Kansas wheat field. Blue was just a Kansas summer sky. All the stories that he told me back when I was just a lad, all the memories that he gave me, and all the good times that he had. Growing up a Kansas farm boy, life was mostly having fun. Riding on his daddy's shoulders, behind a mule beneath the sun. Yes, and joy was just the thing that he was raised on. Love was just a way to live and die. Gold was just a windy Kansas wheat field. Blue was just a Kansas summer sky. Well, I guess there were some hard times, and I'm told some years were lean. They had a storm in 47. Twister came and stripped him clean. Lost the farm and he lost his family. Lost the wheat and lost his home. But he found the family Bible. Faith as solid as a stone. Yes, and joy was just the thing that he was raised on. Love was just a way to live and die. Gold was just a windy Kansas wheat field. Blue was just a Kansas summer sky. So he came to live at our house, and he came to work the land. He came to ease my daddy's burden, and he came to be my friend. So I wrote this down for Matthew, and it's for him this song is sung. Riding on his daddy's shoulders, behind a mule beneath the sun. Yes, and joy was just the thing he was raised on. Love was just a way to live and die. Gold was just a windy Kansas wheat field. Blue was just a Kansas summer sky.
Mr. Dan Wheatman in Lake Effect Studio. Wow. And you were in the audience when that first... I remember when that song was released.
Yeah. It's my favorite John Denver song, bar none. I just love that tune.
Well, it's a story song, too, and there's something about that. And that is part of that wonderful American folk and country tradition of telling stories through the songs. It's not just pretty verse and a melody, you know, kind of thing. There's actually something underneath.
Yeah.
When you and Randy were working on putting this show together and doing the editing that you were describing and coming up with the story that we're going to see on stage, how difficult was it to edit your life? Because that's what you were doing.
Yes. It was a very interesting process, Bonnie. It was a very interesting, especially, you know, the first part is really about me growing up and going to Colorado, my first time there, and running into John, being in this band. I got asked to be part of the band Liberty when the guy who wrote the song that John had recorded, John Summers, joined John Denver's band. He's also the guy that wrote Thank God I'm a Country Boy.
Okay.
Yeah. So I joined Liberty, and then we did a record for John and went out on the road. My first gig with him was the opening act on a big tour, 53 concerts in 51 days. Yeah, all across America. It was great. It was great fun. Anyway, the show goes on from there. Liberty breaks up. I get asked to be in John's band as a bass singer, by the way. So singing, I didn't even know there was another 10 o'clock until I was 30. So we went on the road, and then in that second act, in the second part of the – that's where my marriage starts to dissolve, and that's where my life takes a really different turn. And John's too at the same time, you know. And the very last, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes of the show, sitting in the rehearsal hall working on that, a lot of times I just had to be quiet. You know, I just had to sit there and listen to the ideas and where they were going to go with it. I was mentored by a guy named Donovan Marley, who ran the Denver Center Theater when I first – he was the artistic director. And one of the first things he said to me when I started writing was, you've got to be willing to kill the baby. It can't be so precious that you can't let go of something. And as a songwriter, I've known this a long time. You might write a verse that is you just think's incredible, but it just doesn't fit with everything else in the song. And you have to, you know, put that aside and write another song around it sometime in order to make what you're working on the best it can be. And then we started – we worked all through it and got it all hammered out. And then we started staging it, started doing the blocking. And the first scene in the show – is actually as if Katie Deal, who is the gal in a beautiful voice, great gal, perfect for this. She has a real innocence in her singing. So there's a pre-recorded John, just him and the guitar, and it's playing, and they come out in the dark and they stand at these two microphones as if they're on stage singing like I'm singing backup to John. And the first time we did that, and I just got sort of overwhelmed by the whole thing. And they finished and there was this big nose blow.
I have something in my eye.
Yeah.
Is it hard for you now? I mean, he's gone. Is it hard for you to like see him recreated or be thinking about him in that way on stage?
There's a very interesting thing in my relationship with John in that of all the people I've ever known in my life, living and dead, he visits my dreams more than anyone else, more consistently. And it's not like it's all the time, but if you were sort of make a chart of, okay, my mom, you know, my next door neighbor when I was six, whatever, you know, John comes and talks to me a lot. He just kind of hangs out. I mean, it's not like I'm getting information from him, but I see him in my dream. I'll see him in my dreams. and that's I mean, we were friends before I worked with him, and he remains a dear friend to me.
You're very lucky that he visits.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't always.
No, they don't.
No. They don't. They're kind of ornery when they get to wherever they're going and decide what they want to do and what they're not.
Yeah.
But if there was one thing you want an audience to know about John and about Dan Wheatman that they didn't know before, what would it be?
Well, I think the most asked question about John is what you saw. Was he portraying himself or was that an act? And of course, he's an entertainer, but the seed of all that was very real, very, very. He was a great guy. He was a really great guy. And having worked with other people and having a lot of friends in the business that have worked with other stars, it was great. I mean, we hung. We did stuff together, the whole band and John. I mean, when we were on the road, it was great. To me, the story, I hope, I mean, what was driving me about all this when I found out that we were going to do it was to make a human story, to make a story that anyone could relate to. It's couched in me being on the road with John Denver and my relationship with this other human being, but it's also about the struggles of keeping a relationship alive, the struggles of being in your job and making that job real every time you do it. You know, just getting up in the morning and doing your job and being a human and keeping some kind of heart in all of that.
Your job just happened to be getting up and playing fabulous music with fabulous musicians.
Oh, my God. The band was incredible. And when I first joined, it was all people. It was John Summers, who I knew, and a guy named Steve Weisberg, and Dick Caniss, who was the upright bass player for Peter, Paul, and Mary. And the only real big name in it was Hal Blaine. Now, if you haven't seen the Wrecking Crew film, which is about the Wrecking Crew were the group of musicians in L.A. that did all of the records. When you hear the Beach Boys, that's the Wrecking Crew. Mamas and the Papas, that's the Wrecking Crew. Paul Simon, all that stuff, that's all those guys. And Hal Blaine is the most recorded musician, I think, in the world. And he was the drummer. Well, I did two jobs with that band, and the band completely changed. And then it was James Burton on guitar, who started off, Susie Q, the original. That was him from Dale Hawkins out of Louisiana. But then he joined Ricky Nelson's band, and he played in Elvis. He was in the original Hot Band with Emmylou Harris. He was one of the guys from the Wrecking Crew, a million records under his belt. And Glenn Hardin and Emery Gordy, and the banjo player was Herb Peterson, who played in the Dillards and was also sang duets with Emmylou and me.
Well, Dan Wheatman, it has been such a pleasure.
Oh, it's my pleasure,
talking with
Bonnie.
You and hearing about this. So looking forward to the show. I'm hoping that you will play us out with something.
Oh,
and
dear.
It's your choice. Whatever
My
you
choice.
Would like.
Okay. Gosh. Like I said, I'm the bass singer, so John's songs, Colorado Rocky Mountain High, you know, it's about there. But let me see. If... There's a storm across the valley. Clouds are rolling in. The afternoon is heavy on your shoulders. There's a truck out on the four lane, a mile or more away. The whining of his wheels just makes you colder.
Dan Wheatman is the co-creator, along with Randy Myler, of the world premiere stage show Back Home Again on the Road with John Denver. The show is open through early November at Milwaukee Rep's Stackner Cabaret. And that is Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and each weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.
Hey, it's good to be back home again. Sometimes this old farm feels like a long-lost friend. Yes, and hey, it's good to be back home again.